Thank you, Mr. Schoenberger. We'll hear argument next in number 92641, Leonard Nobleman against the American Savings Bank. Mr. Palmer.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the basic issue in this case is whether sections 506A of the Bankruptcy Code and section 1322B2 are compatible and can be harmonized, or whether they are hostile and conflict. It is the position of the petitioner that they are compatible and they can be harmonized. The function of Code Section 506A is to divide a claim into secured and unsecured parts. A creditor who is undersecured under 506A may wind up with two claims, one of which is a secured claim to the extent of the value of the collateral, and the excess or any amount above that becomes an unsecured claim. We know that 506A does apply in Chapter 13 because the Code tells us it does in Section 103A. But does it apply specifically to Chapter 13, Code Section 1322B2? Everything I've said so far is little in dispute between the parties, but we now reach the point where the ways divide. The respondents argue that it does not apply, and an argument that is based upon the other than clause that is found in Section 1322. The clause that reads, other than a claim secured only by a security interest in the real property that is the debtor's principal residence. As you look at the various respondent positions taken, they differ somewhat between themselves as to why the other than clause excludes the application of 506A. American Savings and Freddie Mac specifically focus on the word rights to tell us that the other than clause modifies only the word rights. Nations Bank, Fannie Mae, and the Chapter 13 trustee look to almost the same thing, rights of holders. Whereas the Realtor Group, Fannie Mae again, and Freddie Mac look to the word claims, which they define by going back to the definitional section of the code, to determine that a claim is both a secured and an unsecured claim, indeed a right to payment. None of the respondents look to the word secured or secured claim together. Now, the argument for the application of 506A can be made first by the rule of last antecedent, which was applied by the Ninth Circuit in the Bellamy case, to say you should look to the words that immediately precede the clause in question. Not just claims, but Bellamy looked to the adjective as well, secured claims. Another approach is that when several words are followed by a clause, and the clause is just as applicable to the first word or the last word or middle words, that clause should be read as applicable to all, which was an approach espoused by Justice O'Connor and Kennedy in the Ron Paire dissent. Either approach is fatal, because either approach puts the word secured back into 1322b2, and it is secured that is as fatal as an assassin's bullet here, because a secured claim is determined by 506A, and 506A is what the respondents must avoid. Now, if, as those opposed to the application of 506A would argue, that it was not meant to apply, one thought which occurs is that the clause could have been put at the very first of 1322b2, or at the very end, in effect to start off by saying other than what I'll call a homestead mortgage, the debtor may modify secured or unsecured claims, and you could reach the same reasoning at the end. Or, as another alternative, Congress intended that both the secured and the unsecured homestead liens were untouchable, put in something equivalent to the 1111B option that is found in Chapter 11 and with which all respondents seem to be happy. But none of those things happened. And if you simply take the statute as it reads, 506A, for the determination of what is a secured claim, and 1322 by either of the techniques of the other than clause, you come out with a statute that is consistent, it harmonizes, there is no conflict. We do not need to search further for the intention of Congress because it is expressed clearly.
But your clients weren't trying to alter a secured claim.
They were not, and in fact have not. But in answering that, of course, the operable words are secured claim. If you accept, as we do, 506A, that secured claim is only the $23,500 the condominium was worth, we're not altering.
Mr. Palmer, I'm not sure that 1332B2 refers to secured claim. The language is a claim secured only by security interest. I'm not sure that necessarily means the same thing.
And that argument...
It's an identification of the instance in which the... where there is a security interest in real property that is the principal residence, it says no modification of the rights of holders could be made. And I think you also have to deal with the language, modify the rights of holders. I suppose a holder can hold both rights to secured and unsecured claims.
Let me answer or speak to the first one first, and then we'll come to the rights of holders. The secured claims that I was referring to is the language that is before the comma in 1322b2. The secured only by a security interest. The argument has been made that to really say clearly what I am arguing, you would have to say secured claim, secured. And that is rejected by Bellamy upon the proposition that that would be a wooden and awkward way to force Congress to express his intent that there is really no significant difference between a secured claim and a claim secured. And of course, our position would be the same as Bellamy. On the rights of holders, if I may borrow your own language from the Ron Paire dissent.
That's dangerous business, I see.
It's been cited several times for the grammatical analysis, which frankly does appeal to me at this moment. If you accept that there is some uncertainty as to what the other than clause applies, if you do not accept the Bellamy rule of last antecedent, then we seem to fall right into the analysis that you made with considerable and respectable authority, I might add, that it must apply to the whole thing, rights of holders of secured claims. But what are the rights of the holders of the secured claims? And that brings us back, I think, to the operative word secured claim. We're not now speaking about the rights of holders of secured or partially secured or secured and unsecured claims, but only secured claims. There are some other points that lead to somewhat the same analysis.
Mr. Palmer, I hope you'll discuss either now or after we return from the noon recess the bearing you think that Duznip, our opinion Duznip against Tim, has on this. It seems to me that although it may not be controlling, it certainly cuts against some of your arguments.
Duznip and Lean pass through. We can certainly start it now and may not finish it. There is a question of whether or not Duznip forecloses the argument that was made here. And, of course, all are aware that that was a Chapter 7 case. All are aware that that was dealing to 506D. And I think all are aware that that was the issue there was whether or not an abandonment would revive the lien that appeared by its terms to be cut off under 506D. And what I think the court held, and properly, was that 506D applies only when it is not an allowed secured claim, because otherwise code liens would not pass through the Act the way that Act liens did. Now, when I say pass through, I think this court was speaking in terms of unadministered. They come into the estate at the beginning, but they are abandoned out of the estate, and they should go out as they came in with the same lien encumbered. That was the old Bankruptcy Act rule, and it was the court found nothing in the Code of the Legislative History to indicate any intent to change that. And the results of implying such a change would be a rather unfair windfall to the debtor, because it would be a permanent reduction even though it no longer served a bankruptcy purpose. But none of those considerations apply here. Chapter 13, as indeed do Chapter 11 and 12, have a built-in protection against the windfall problem. Chapters 11 and 12 keep the property in the estate. Abandonment is not a problem. I see nothing in the Duznip case that indicates that it would move beyond the Chapter 7 abandonment factual situation the court applied it to. There is a reference in Duznip, and the Chapter 13 trustee here speaks to it in her brief, that 506A does not by itself avoid liens. It simply classifies claims into secured and unsecured, but that something furthers, I recall she used the word catalyst, some catalyst is required. And this court determined that 506D did not apply in Chapter 7. Even if you were to assume that the Duesnip opinion should be expanded to say 506D does not apply in Chapter 13 either, that's not the catalyst that avoids the excess lien in Chapter 13. Instead, it's Section 1327C, which is the effect of confirmation rule that reduces the property to the value mechanically it revests the property in the debtor free and clear of whatever amount has been determined to be in excess of value. It's a 1327C trigger and a discharge under 1328, except as to long-term debts assumed by the plan, which would include the mortgage as reduced and obviously Duesnip spoke to none of those issues. I don't think they were before the court, and I see Duesnip as a case somewhat limited in its scope to arrive at a proper result.
We'll resume. Mr. Palmer, you may resume.
When we took our noon break, we were discussing Duesnip, and I'd like to pick up again at that point. Duesnip, of course, was a Chapter 7 case. Duesnip did not involve homestead or residence. It involved farmland in Utah. And the argument was made in Duesnip that because there had been a valuation of the property at a value well below the total amount of the debt, that was something akin to an albatross branded to that property, even after that property was abandoned from the bankruptcy estate so that no distribution purpose in the bankruptcy remained. The court felt, and I think with justification, that was an unfair result. Should the property appreciate in value, it would create a windfall to the debtor. The court found 506D ambiguous. And having made that initial determination, then determined that the court was uncomfortable in changing pre-code law on ambiguous language when there was no legislative history whatever to support it. But we turn then to Chapter 13 and its differences. Chapter 13, of course, is one of the rehabilitation sections. The property is not abandoned from the estate, but remains in the estate. That is true, even if there is no objection to the exemption status as homestead. Exempt property does not pass from the Chapter 13 estate until after the plan has been confirmed. And only then, under 1327, does it pass from the estate. The purpose of determining exemptions in Chapter 13 is not as in Chapter 7, to have it passed from the estate, but to determine whether or not the debtor must include in its payments to creditors an amount equal to all of its non-exempt property. Now, that's all a Chapter 7 debtor does, is surrender his non-exempt property. But a Chapter 13 debtor is required to do more than that. The Chapter 13 debtor must not only pay the value of all of his non-exempt property, but must also pay his non-disposable income, that is to say the excess under his monthly budget, his non-disposable income for 3 years to get the benefits of a Chapter 13. Chapter 13 is a favored chapter in bankruptcy, and that has been a consistent purpose of Congress, and that's well reflected in legislative history throughout.
Favored over Chapter 7, Mr. Palmer?
Favored over Chapter 7, because Chapter 13 presents a man who is doing more than the legal minimum that he would have to do to receive a discharge of his debts.
Under Chapter 7.
Than he would have to do under Chapter 7, yes, sir.
But he also gets some benefits from Chapter 13 that a Chapter 7 debtor doesn't.
That is true. Otherwise, I assume it'd be very hard to sell. But those benefits are these. A person will consider Chapter 7 when he needs to take an Internal Revenue Service, a tax debt, otherwise non-dischargeable, and wants to pay it out over a period of time, where he wishes to save a homestead, because DUSA now makes it clear Chapter 7 will not help him save a homestead. Or in those states where exemptions are parsimonious and he would rather value and pay for his furniture, car, etc., than give them up. Those are the benefits of Chapter 13. Saving a homestead, will not deny, is a major benefit in Chapter 13, and one reason why many people select Chapter 13. But if the respondents prevail today, that incentive will be taken away, and there will be more people filing Chapter 7 than 13. Well, there is another I should mention, and that is that the grounds for objection to discharge in Chapter 13 are more restrictive than they are in 7. That's really not a major consideration for the average couple, but it's also a benefit of 13 over 7.
Mr. Palmer, would you explain how your system works? How can it be that where you have a single instrument of indebtedness that covers both the secured and the unsecured claim, you can comply with what you contend the provision says, and that is allow the instrument to be modified as to the unsecured claim, but not allow it to be modified as to the secured claim? How does one go about doing that?
Let me begin by explaining it in an area where there is absolutely no controversy between the parties. The $50,000 lien on the $1,000 automobile. All the same instruments are the same. Security agreement instead of a deed of trust, but other than that, exactly the same. 506A and 1322B2 clearly permit evaluation of the lien, the secured claim, to $1,000 on the proposition that that's all the car is worth. If the car were abandoned, the lien holder could get no more than the $1,000 fair market value and have an unsecured claim for $49,000. If we move it to a homestead, the result is exactly the same. Unless, of course, the other than clause gives more protection than we say it does. The creditor will have a $23,500 secured claim in this case.
I understand that. I'm not asking for the difference between the secured and the unsecured. I understand that. But for the car or for the homestead, I have the same problem about how you can allow a unitary instrument which covers a claim, part of which is secured and part of which is unsecured, but it's just one instrument. How can you allow it to be modified as to the secured portion of the claim, but not as to the unsecured portion of the claim? Or vice versa, which is what 1322B2 requires. How can you do that? It's a single instrument that covers both.
Well, the single instrument is fine as between the parties and in a non-bankruptcy context. But when you go into a bankruptcy, 506A applies whether the debt's in one instrument or two instruments.
Well, I understand that, but the other side says we don't have to worry about this problem. Given our interpretation, you simply can't modify it if it's a homestead. You say yes, you can, but you can only modify it. You can only modify it as to the unsecured. How does one go about modifying it just as to the unsecured?
Well, At the inception, we apply 506 and 1322B2, and we've talked about that. Then we have confirmation. The confirmation section, which is 1327, provides in section C that all of the property of the estate, not otherwise dealt with, revests in the debtor free and clear of any amount other than the secured claim. So that's how we get our one instrument down to a 23.5.
Well, we're not talking about the revesting provision. What we're talking about is whether the rights can be modified in the plan. That's the provision we're discussing here. Now, give me an example of how one can modify the rights pertaining to this unitary instrument only as to the unsecured portion, but not as to the secured portion. How does one go about
doing? We're not going to modify the unsecured rights. We're going to treat them as unsecured rights under the plan. The remaining portion of the claim is unsecured. The plan will treat of unsecured claims.
But the provision we're talking about is a provision that allows rights to be modified. Right? I mean, that's the provision before us.
That's 506A, I think.
Right. And as at issue is whether the exception to that, which says you can't modify rights as to homestead, whether that covers all rights in the homestead agreement or only those rights that are secured. And well, you say the latter, right?
I say the latter.
Just give me an example of a real-life mortgage agreement in which you modify the unsecured portion but not the secured portion. And I really don't understand what it means to say that.
That approaches it backwards, I have to admit, in the way I've always looked at it.
Well, I do things that way, I guess.
I've always looked at it that we're modifying the secured portion and thereby automatically making the rest unsecured. I don't know of any case that ever dealt with modifying the unsecured portion of the claim. Once it's become an unsecured portion, the debtor can deal with it in his plan.
I don't know if there's a case or not, but if it's impossible to do, if you can't give me an example of how it might be done, I will be inclined to think that your reading of the provision is wrong, since it makes no sense. Just tell me how one would do it if one wanted to do it.
All right. I would think that you could propose a plan that says we will value down all secured claims, homestead, car, etc., to fair market value, and we will pay 25 cents on the dollar for all unsecured claims. There I've modified unsecured claims, which I have a right to do. That's not in dispute. I have a right to modify unsecured claims.
Does the... In 13, does if the secured creditor wants to participate, does he have to file a claim?
All claims are supposed to be filed in a 13. There's nothing equivalent to 1111A. Where
under 506, does a secured creditor with 506 in mind, does he just file a claim for the full amount of his security?
Traditionally, yes.
And he never then files a claim for the unsecured portion?
No. The debtor draws the issue by filing the plan,
yes,
which says, as they did here, we value your equity at $23,500. That will be the amount of your secured claim.
But the secured creditor has filed a claim for the full amount.
Has filed a claim for the full amount.
As a secured claim.
As a secured claim.
And so the secured creditor, whether it's a homestead or not, he has a chance to litigate the value that they have assigned.
That is so. And that was, in effect, done here at the confirmation hearing. But of all the Court of Appeals cases, the four that conflict with the Fifth Circuit decision, every one of those, the values were agreed or stipulated. Apparently, it's not a big battle.
Yeah.
But the opportunity is always there. There's one thing that...
Mr. Is this Another point, or are you still responding to the same one?
No, it was another point. Go ahead.
Before you do that, let's take a real... I'm not satisfied, or I don't understand your answer to my previous question. Suppose you have a mortgage that provides for payments of $500 a month, all right? And that's for the whole thing, for the secured and the unsecured. How do you modify the unsecured portion of that mortgage without modifying the secured portion? Don't the payments still have to be $500 a month?
They do. They do. That's what we contend is the meaning of the other than clause. We must continue to pay the same mortgage amount.
But even if that is so, you're still modifying it because you're not going to pay the same mortgage amount for or the same periodic payment amount for the same period of time. No matter how you cut it, you've got to modify something with respect to what's left of the secured portion.
Well, if you reduce the balance that's due, the unpaid principal, if you will, to the 23.5, when the payments after interest service have reached 23.5, that lien will be paid off.
Yeah, and the lien would also be paid off if you make the same number of payments you had agreed to make before, but they were smaller payments. Sure. So no matter which way you go, you've modified something with respect to the secured claim beyond the amount of the lien.
I have reduced the amount of the debt by what we have determined to be unsecured.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Mr. Schroeder, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Mr. Palmer was correct when he said that this case involves an interpretation of one or more statutes. I'd like to reread Section 1322 for the Court, the pertinent portions of that statute. If the Court wants to follow along, that statute is reprinted in page 3 of American Savings Brief. The pertinent provisions of 1322b2 state that the plan may modify the rights of holders of secured claims other than a claim secured only by a security interest in real property that is the debtor's principal residence. Taking a plain and clear look at the language of this statute, it appears that the word rights is the grammatical object of the word modify. Modify, what are we modifying? We're modifying the rights. In addition, the term secured claim, again in that first phrase, is preceded by the preposition of. It's our contention that those three words together, of secured claim, is merely definitional and defines the type of holder that the Congress was talking about when they passed this statute. They're talking about a holder of a secured claim. Now, applying Mr. Palmer's rule...
Other than the holder of a claim secured only by a security...
That's correct, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. All right.
And applying Mr. Palmer's rule of last antecedent, several courts which have allowed lien strip down have simply gone back and applied the other than words simply to the phrase secured claim. It's our position that the better application, according to that particular rule, is to apply the other than phrase to the rights of holders of secured claims.
Under your view, what is the result if there is a second mortgage as to which there is no adequate security at all? Say that in this case there were a second mortgage. Even the first is not satisfied. Is the second mortgagee a holder of a secured claim?
So long as he had a perfected security interest in the property at the time of the filing of bankruptcy, he would be a secured creditor. That's correct. The debtor...
Even though the value of the property does not support any portion of his security, any portion of his claim is a secured claim.
That's correct. He would be a secured creditor. However, his security interest would be undersecured. In your example, there would be no value in the property to support his security interest. Nonetheless, because he has, for example, a second lien mortgage or deed of trust, he would ostensibly be classified as a secured creditor because he has a security interest claim against property of the debtor in the bankruptcy proceeding.
It's difficult for me to square that with 506A. I know we're not talking about a second here, but I want to see how the statute works.
I understand that, Your Honor. And until the legislature clarifies your concern, it's our interpretation that the same treatment must be accorded to a first, second, or third lien holder against residential real property without regard to the value of the property. And let me, if I can, explain how I arrive at that conclusion. Mr. Palmer's client would have this court believe that 506A automatically kicks in to affect the claim or security claim rights of a holder as defined in Section 1322. It's our position that 506A doesn't necessarily automatically kick in to define the term secured claim in that instance. The term secured claim is merely definitional, again, of the type of holder that the statute's talking about.
Well, I suppose your colleague on the other side would the meaning he would ascribe to 1322b2 would be the same if it just read the plan may modify secured claims other than a claim secured by, and which the meaning for him, the meaning wouldn't change if you left out the words the rights of holders of. Is that right?
I think for Mr. Palmer's position, that would be correct. But the way the statute's not written that way. The statute is written that it's the rights that are protected by the other than clause in the clause that's after the comma.
But rights you figure are those rights defined by state law?
I'll get into that argument.
But you have to get to it because otherwise you could argue that the rights are those that they're described in 506, namely, you've got a secured claim only to the extent of the value of the property.
Well, we would take the position, Your Honor, that the term rights, as opposed to the words claim and security interest and lien and other words of art in the bankruptcy code, the word rights is not defined anywhere in the bankruptcy code itself.
Well, it's state law rights, I guess.
Well, this court in Doosnip gave us some direction as to some of the rights that a holder of a mortgage has with respect to its note and deed of trust or mortgage that it comes into the bankruptcy court in as a creditor of the bankruptcy estate. This court, for example, in Doosnip, has said that it is the creditor, not the debtor, who has the benefit of an increase in value so as to avoid a windfall to the debtor. In that case, I believe that's one right. Another right that the Doosnip court set forth was the right to have the lien pass through bankruptcy unaffected. In addition, this court in the Barnhill case, in interpreting the words property and interest in property, said that in the absence of controlling federal law, we may look to state law. So by analogy, I think to answer your question, yes, we may look to state law in determining what rights are.
Well, I'm surprised this is even an issue. I mean, the provision doesn't mean very much if it means the only rights you may modify are the lien rights in particular. I mean, surely it means you can modify the rights that are the substantive rights to which the lien attaches. The right to payment by a certain date, the right to a certain amount of payments every month, and so forth and so on.
And that's exactly...
Certainly everybody understands that's what it means.
And that's exactly...
And those are state rights, aren't they?
That's correct.
So why isn't your answer to Justice White simply yes, it includes state rights?
Yes, it does include state rights. but there are...
But limited to... Under 1322, you're talking... That word rights refers only to the rights of the holder that he acquired prior to bankruptcy under state law.
Yes, because I think the rights that any creditor would have in bankruptcy are those defined by the bankruptcy code.
That's
so,
right.
Yes. And Justice Scalia, your analysis is exactly our point. The other than clause must affect all those rights, those bundle of rights that a secured creditor such as my client would take with him into bankruptcy. In addition,
Mr. Schroeder, could I just interrupt
yes,
you for
sir.
A second with what I assume is an easier question, but I take it on your theory, if the one lien holder had a second mortgage and a separate piece of property, he wouldn't have any protection.
That's correct. Okay. If it's non-homestead, for example.
Second one is not homestead, that's right. One, he's got a lien on the homestead, and then he's got a second mortgage. He doesn't get protected.
That would be our interpretation, yes. Because
right means the right to which the lien, that's a lien on a homestead, relates.
Correct.
Okay.
No, but you're also identifying the person who can claim anything as the person whose lien is solely on the homestead property.
And that's because in our view, that's the way the statute is written. The other than clause refers to those creditors having a claim on real property that is the debtor's principal residence. So it's under that.
And that alone.
And that, under that statute alone, that seems where that protection is directed. That's correct. In addition, under that second clause, the other than clause, the other than clause of 1322b2 refers to a claim in the singular. It does not refer a second time to secured claim or the secured portion of a claim or something else. It refers to a claim. And under section 101.5a, of the bankruptcy code, claim is defined as any right to payment, whether or not such right is secured or unsecured.
To be fair, it refers not just to a claim, but to a claim secured, which is poetic for secured claim.
Some courts have interpreted that way. Yes, Your Honor. Other commentators have found that there is a difference between the term secured claim as may be defined in 506A and claim secured by, where the word secured is definitional.
Only lawyers could come up with that sort of thing. And so you are.
That's what I was told when I got my certificate from this court.
Counsel, what can the debtor in a Chapter 13 proceeding do then in a situation such as the noblemen's have? Just leave the residence out of the proceeding altogether and let it be taken by the mortgage holder?
They have several elections or alternatives, and some of the alternatives are not very realistic. One alternative would be to cure any existing arrearage immediately so there is no problem with the mortgage company. Most debtors wouldn't be in bankruptcy in the first place if they had that ability to do that. Another alternative would be, and this is what I believe the legislature intended in Senator DeConcini's comments went to, is that a claim such as the one claimed by American Savings Bank, the debtor would elect to cure and maintain payments under Section 1322b5. Under 1322b5, a homestead debtor typically takes a pre-petition arrearage that existed on the mortgage loan prior to bankruptcy, puts it into his plan, and depending on what district you're in, either makes direct, regular monthly post-petition payments to the creditor or through the trustee to the creditor. That's an election that a creditor in the nobleman's position could take.
Yeah, but he's not only got to make up arrearages, he's got to pay the current amounts.
That's correct. And that's the way the code's written.
Well, and in your position, pay off the whole principal balance, even though the property isn't worth it at all. So does he have another alternative, just walk away from it?
He can walk away from it. He can go into a Chapter 7 and get his personal liability discharged, which is going to get him potentially better off than if he were to go through a Chapter 13.
Well, if he wants to walk away from it, would he have to do it in a Chapter 7 proceeding?
If he wants to avoid personal liability, that's correct, Your Honor. In Chapter 13, the discharge provision, Section 1328, has an exception. There are certain debts which are accepted to discharge in the Chapter 13, which are not accepted to in Chapter 7.
And one of those is long-term debt, where the last payment on the debt is on a date further into the future than the last payment date in the Chapter 13 case. So potentially in the situation we're talking about,
a debtor may be better off going into a 7 because he would have the receipt of a Chapter 7 discharge, would receive that personal liability relief, but obviously he would lose his home. The creditor more than likely would ask the court to lift the stay or modify the stay to allow foreclosure to proceed.
Now, a majority of the circuits have gone the other way.
That's correct.
How do you explain that? They just take the petitioner's view of this thing, I guess, in terms of how to read the statute.
Well, if I might answer your question, Your Honor, by addressing
the four specific cases individually. In the Hoagland case, which came out of the Ninth Circuit, which was the first of the pro-lien-stripping cases,
it appears from a reading of the text that that court was predisposed as to its decision. There is some verbiage in that decision which says we can't believe
that a mortgage creditor
wouldn't have an equity cushion in the first place.
They also
do, as my opponent is suggesting, automatically take 506A and force it into 1322B2 just because the Chapter 5 provisions of the Bankruptcy Code are ones of general applicability to all other substantive provisions. The Wilson case is somewhat distinguishable. The same result was reached there, but in that case, the creditor had
additional
collateral beyond the homestead. And so the court, in part, almost in passing, but it did recognize that additional collateral beyond the homestead was claimed by the mortgage company in that case. So that case is somewhat distinguishable. In the Hart case, we have the same situation where we had a mobile home on real property and other collateral. Again, that is somewhat distinguishable. That's not what the facts that court necessarily relied on in reaching its decision, but those were considered by that court in the result that took place. In the most recent case, the Bellamy case, the court there takes a somewhat circular analysis of the statutes in effect. The court, by that time, had heard several arguments, and as a matter of fact, the creditor involved in that case, the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, made the argument that it was rights and not the secured claim that was subject to modification in 1322b2. The Bellamy Court, on one page of its decision, said, yeah, that might be the case. You may be correct in saying that it is the rights that are the subject of the adjective modify. However, the real question is whether it means unsecured rights or secured rights. And then it goes on to make a statement about the code being a substantial change from the Act, which it was, and therefore, without really looking at the terms of the statute, therefore, we must only be talking about secured claims. A couple of pages later in that same decision, that court goes and automatically, as the Hoagland, Wilson, and Hart courts did, take the other than phrase and apply it to the words secured claim, just as if it had forgotten that it already used the rule of last antecedent to apply to the entire phrase of that preceding phrase.
So your submission is that a plan may not be confirmed unless it provides for the payment of the entire principal amount.
To a home mortgage lender,
yes.
That's correct.
And no part of it can be treated as an unsecured claim.
What may?
Not necessarily.
How may the rights of unsecured creditors be modified in a Chapter 13 proceeding?
How may the unsecured rights mm-hmm. be modified?
Do they have to pay them at all?
In a Chapter 13 proceeding, a debtor is required to submit to the court, as required by the code, his disposable income. That income that is over and above his living expenses,
right.
simply. That disposable income, it goes in part to pay certain claims in the bankruptcy case. Priority claims,
sure.
potentially attorney fees,
yes.
unsecured creditors.
How about secured creditors?
Secured creditors are dealt with, and potentially secured creditors, for example, the pre-petition arrearage on a home mortgage loan.
Well, principal amount? The unpaid principal amount?
The unpaid principal amount in a typical residential mortgage situation
yes.
is going to be included in part in the pre-petition arrearage.
Yes.
Because the pre-petition arrearage...
Right, but now the rest of the unpaid amount.
But now the unpaid amount?
The rest of it, yeah.
It's our position that there cannot be any modification on that. Mm-hmm. Whether it is secured or not, because the reading of the statute
says that...
It is the rights,
yeah.
whether secured or not,
those
rights cannot be modified yeah. as against a residential...
Suppose that the disposable income is not enough to pay anything more than, it obviously isn't enough ever to pay off unsecured claims, all of them.
That's right. Usually that's the case, yes.
Yes, and so the balance is, when he pays what he can, he's discharged from
them. That is correct, except as to,
again, under the 1328 discharge section,
certain debts. There are certain debts,
including long-term debts.
But in any event, the principal amount, the unpaid principal amount of the contract on or the mortgage on the principal residence
just lingers. He's never discharged from that. That is our position. Yes.
May I just ask to get one thing clear in my mind? What is your position on whether the interference with your right, otherwise existing right to foreclose, would be a modification of your rights?
That is my position on that.
Your Honor, is dealt with by another section of the Bankruptcy Code,
specifically Section 362 of the Bankruptcy Code, and in certain cases, Section 1301 of the Bankruptcy Code, which imposes upon the filing of a bankruptcy petition an automatic stay.
So this is done by statute rather than by a plan.
That's correct.
Mm.
That's correct. And what 1322 speaks to, Your Honor, is a plan may modify other than.
That is not a modification caused by the plan.
That's correct. That's a statutory modification. And that is something that we live with. In addition,
Mr. Schroeder, what if you have two mortgages on the property, okay, and even the first one is undersecured? Under your reading, is the second mortgage also protected?
Under our reading of the statute, the way it is currently written, yes.
Even though that second mortgage doesn't even qualify as a secured claim at all? It's not even under 506.
Under 506, it may not be secured. That's correct. But
it is not secured. It may not. In the hypothetical I gave you, it is not.
That
is not a secured claim under 506A.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But under your reading, it would have full protection under as a second mortgage, even though the first mortgage gobbles up the entire value of the security.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Wow.
And so our position would be that the debtors need to make some elections and some choices about whether that home is worth keeping or not.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, Your Honor, in our case, American Savings Bank is, according to the findings of the bankruptcy court below, undersecured. They have a first lien on the property, but the value of the property, as found by the bankruptcy court, is less than the total debt.
Well, I would think under your position, in this case, it would be better for the for the homeowner just to say, go ahead and foreclose, just abandon the property to you?
Yes, that would be an election that I think would make sense for the homeowner.
And what rights would you have then, by the way, in the, would, say you foreclosed, would you have any secured claim that you might have to, that you could get paid off or possibly get paid off under the plan?
No secured claim after liquidation of the collateral through foreclosure. That's correct.
But you'll still have a deficiency.
That's correct.
And that is still, except for the bankruptcy, he would still owe it.
That's correct.
Will he still owe it to you if he abandons the property to you?
Yes. Let me answer that question this way. It may depend on how he abandons the property to the creditor. There is a practice in the Northern District Bankruptcy Court of Texas whereby certain debtors attempt to abandon property in full satisfaction of the debt to the creditor.
I would have thought that your deficiency would be discharged in the proceeding.
It may be discharged in that's a question that I don't think is before this court today.
It may not be, but it's kind of an interesting question, isn't it?
That you're right, and the answer I would give to your question is that I do not believe the way that Chapter 13 is set up is that deficiency would be discharged because of Section 1328, which has the certain exceptions to discharge for Chapter 13. One of the exceptions is long-term debt. And that note is still due and payable 25 years in the future, or whatever the maturity date is, which may be outside the 3 or 5 year plan that the Chapter 13 debtor is in. So potentially, yes, even a deficiency after foreclosure in a bankruptcy may not be non-dischargeable. Now,
say it didn't exceed the length of time that it didn't exceed that length of time. Would it be discharged?
Yes, it would.
Because why?
Because it does not fall within the exception of Section 1328.
Well, I know, but why in the first place would it be discharged? Would you have filed a deficiency?
My client would.
Your client would have filed an amended exactly
proof of claim for the deficiency after foreclosure.
And it would be discharged
if the last payment fell within the 3 or 5 year period of the plan.
May I just be sure I understood one of your answers to Justice Scalia? Assume the hypothetical of a second mortgage in this case, in which the first mortgage is undersecured. Is the person who holds the second mortgage, does he have a secured or an unsecured claim?
When he comes into the bankruptcy proceeding, before there's any claim determination or any action by the debtor, that creditor holds a security agreement or mortgage on property that is the debtor's, that becomes property of the estate when the debtor files bankruptcy. At that point in time, he's a secured creditor. He is a creditor who has security. His security may be nothing. His security may be zero.
All right, but then go to 506. Under 506A, is he a secured creditor?
Under 506A, I believe he's a secured creditor only where he falls within the protection of the other than provision of Section 1322B2. Now, a debtor in bankruptcy has the opportunity in an adversary proceeding under Bankruptcy Rule 7001 to bring an action to determine the extent, validity of a lien or of a claim.
Well, but it seems to me your argument is circular because B2 does not apply except to the holders of secured claims. And under 506A, he's not secured in any degree. So it seems to me perfectly plausible to read B2 as applying to someone who has a holder who has some portion of his claim secured.
Yeah,
in the case supposed
and put to you by Justice Stevens and Justice Scalia and earlier by me, that is not the case with a second mortgagee.
Yes, Your Honor, that is a plausible reading of the two statutes together.
Mr. Schroeder, I'm sure it's in the interest of your clients to protect the second mortgage as well as the first mortgage, but in fact, I can agree with you on the first mortgage here without agreeing with you on the second.
I understand that, Your Honor.
I can read the word, as Justice Kennedy said, the word, the phrase, holder of secured claim. It's thoroughly in accord with your position on the first mortgage to read that to mean a person who holds a claim that is at least in part a secured claim under 506A.
Your Honor, that may be a...
You would want us to go further, but we really don't have to agree with you on the first mortgage.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Schroeder. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.